Katie Gardner is the author of Secret Stories, Cracking the Reading Code with the Brain in Mind. Today we're talking brain research, secret stories, why getting to why is important, how the brain learns, and so much more. Lots to learn. By the way, listen for her to talk about Sneaky Why and Mommy E. You're going to like this. Enjoy.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
Katie Gardner is the author of Secret Stories, Cracking the Reading Code with the Brain in Mind. She's an internationally known educational speaker, author, and literacy consultant with 25 years of elementary classroom experience. Katie has a passion for infusing neuroscience into literacy and learning. She shares brain-changing strategies for boosting existing reading curriculum and phonics instruction with the latest neural research showing how our brains learn best. Her practical and proven methods for bringing neuroscience into the forefront of literacy learning have been shared in both lecture and panel discussions at Harvard and MIT as part of the Learning and the Brain Conference and Research Consortium, and are the subject of an upcoming professional development series. Katie has been a featured keynote speaker at conferences in the United States and abroad, including the Vulnerable Readers series with Dr. Richard Ollington, What Really Matters for Struggling Readers, and Dr. Ann Cunningham, National Early Literacy Panel, NELP Report. Say hi to everyone, Katie.
Hi, and thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to get to talk with you.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking with you, and I appreciate you making time, and it's good to have you here. So thanks. And what I'd like to do is, before we do anything, you got to tell me, you were 25 years in the elementary classroom. What'd you teach, and what'd you like most about working with the kids?
Well, the same thing I still love most when I go into schools. It's like a never-ending comedy sitcom. I mean, the entertainment aspect of not just what they do, but what happens when you try to do all the things that as a teacher you're constantly trying to do, and then just as things occur around you that you just, if you weren't there, you would never believe it. So even just in the little bits of time that I get to spend in classrooms, I am always reminded of how much I miss, you know, just those constant moments of pure joy and entertainment. And that's not even counting what happens when those light bulbs come on and you really know you've, you know, reached a kid in a way that either they hadn't been reached before or they've made a move in a direction they've never gone. There's just so many things that, you know, when you're working with teachers, you still get excited when you have those aha moments. But, you know, kids are so there that they can't hide the level of just pure glee when something just clicks for them that they've never gotten before. You know, and then you've got all the stories that they tell. There's just no other job that replicates what teachers, and I'm going to say, get to experience on a daily basis. Now, I know as a teacher in the classroom day after day, sometimes it's hard to imagine that you're getting to experience it because it can get, you know, you've got other things, obviously, that can interrupt those moments, but they're there. And it's hard to find another job where you have moments like that built into your actual work. So I miss that terribly. And over the 25 years that I was in the classroom or working with teachers in the classroom, you know, I taught so many different things that I really got to see kids from different perspectives. And I think that helps a lot, not just perspectives from different grade levels, but I started teaching in music because I'd gone to Juilliard. I'd gotten my degree there. So I had taken courses over the summer because I always did like the idea of teaching. My mom was a teacher. So I was prepared when I came out of Juilliard, if I didn't want the traveling life, which I ultimately didn't, to be able to teach. So I was lucky in that I got to just jump right in. I just turned 21. And in the music classroom, kids are very different than in their regular classroom because you don't always get a handle on who performs well, who's a good reader, who's, you know, a troublemaker in the classroom. They come to you and their rap or their role can be completely different from the way a teacher views them in the classroom. And I noticed, you know, some of my right-hand men, so to speak, you know, in music, like if you're putting on a show and you've got, you know, it takes a village to do something like that, your fifth graders become like little mini adults in terms of them helping corral the little Ks or the first. And some of the, you know, the students that I relied the most on and thought the most of their teachers just, you know, and I didn't realize this until the end of my first year, but their teachers would roll their eyes and think, him? Oh my gosh, he can't hold his shoe up in my classroom without having 45, you know, accidents with it. And I thought, you know, that this was like just the most responsible, accountable, just right there, ready to go, problem-solving kid. And it was so strange to me to see such a difference in our perspectives until you do start teaching in the classroom, and then you do get a feel for how kids start to develop certain roles. And as their teacher, you get into kind of certain raps, rapports, where, you know, they do and you know what they think about what you do. And you just kind of, I think, pigeonhole each other. And you don't always see kids outside of that context to understand what gifts maybe they do bring to the table, but maybe just not in the math classroom or not in the reading classroom. And of course, kids will, you know, in one environment, they'll carry that, you know, that weight of what just happened here, you know, into the next activity, you know, that occurs in the day. But when they leave that room and go into a completely different place, whether it's the PE, basketball court, you know, whether, again, it's the music classroom. And I'm talking about kids who couldn't even sing. I mean, I'm not talking about the one in particular child that I'm thinking of. He couldn't hold a tune to save his life. He just literally was my right-hand man. We had my other teacher had left for medical leave mid-year, and we had a show with 1,000 kids, and I mean, maids of milking, and, you know, it was a 12 days of Christmas or 12 days of holiday hullabaloo, so it was insane, costumes and staging. And I just relied on this one little guy in particular, and others as well. But I never would have guessed that he was the kid in the class who didn't turn anything in, didn't seem to care, could barely pass. And his mother actually ran into me. I ran into her when he was in high school. He was in fifth grade when I had him. And she said that he graduated because he wasn't, you know, he struggled. He was in some special needs classes. And she said she actually was crying when she talked to me, because she said, Ronald only stayed in school because of you. After that, he went to middle school, and he can't sing, but he joined the choir, and he did all the same stuff for that director that he did for you. And then he went on to high school, did the same thing. She said, and he graduated. And she said, and you know, you were the first person to just make him feel good. And I wasn't trying to make him feel good. I literally needed him. So I put that together with, I remember what his fifth grade teacher told me, and she was a phenomenal teacher, actually, great teacher. But she was cut and dry, you know, serious business. She was there to teach. She was there to learn. And it was mind-boggling how two people could see the same kid and think absolutely. I mean, we would have made horrible witnesses in a crime. Not that he would have committed a crime, but, I mean, we would have had the absolute alternate perspective from one another as to who we saw, what they did, and what was likely to occur. So it gives you a perspective as a teacher to know that, you know, they're not just the way they are with you in that classroom. And sometimes there's a lot more than what you see. And I think especially, you know, over the years, then having gone into kinder, gone into first grade, struggling with things at the kinder level, and then seeing how first grade kind of inherits what kinder creates, and how first grade teachers have to work with where that ball lands and still get to where then second grade needs to be. And then working with fourth and fifth grade kids, and with those grade levels, I worked in a pull-out situation, so I wasn't their core teacher for the day, but I did get to work on plugging those holes for kids who read at a kinder at a first grade level. You know, often you get fourth and fifth grade kids who would even come in for certain groups when you're in the earlier grades to just kind of give them what they need where they need it, but in a way that they're the helper and yet still getting those lower level skills. So just getting that whole perspective, but especially that music, those couple of years in music. And that's really what made me know I wanted to go in the classroom, is when I could reach kids, when I was no longer loyal to my music curriculum, because I was basically just using it as a means to an end to teach skills that kids like Ronald wasn't seemingly able to get in the classroom, but that because he felt so much more confident outside of that environment, I could channel things through this pathway that was music and get some of these core pieces that he didn't have, and not just him, but certainly in the early grades as well. When I was no longer faithful to music curriculum for music's sake, and everything was about trying to teach, I would actually go to teachers and say, what are you trying to work on? What skills don't they have that if I could figure out a way to connect this with something musical, we could kind of implant or connect? And that just got to be so exciting for me that the classroom was where I felt like I needed to be in order to kind of carry that ball further. That's a long answer.
Oh, no. All is good. That's awesome, because, you know, one of the things about teaching that's so cool is that you really don't know what the days are going to be like, and you don't know which kids are going to fill which roles. And as as you come in, they create these roles and who they are. And it's funny because it can be different in each different classroom. It doesn't, you know, just because they're one way with you doesn't mean they're the same way with the another adult down the hallway. And it's and that's one of the aspects of teaching. That's just, you can't explain it to people until they teach.
Right. And your kids, you know, your kids are the same way. You know, you think your daughter's the biggest pain, and then your teacher says, oh, she's just wonderful. And you're thinking, really? Or vice versa. So, you know, you spend a long time together, and you develop a love for your students. But that rapport is one that can be confining if, you know, if you don't have that opportunity to see them in some of these other areas.
Oh, that's so true. So true. So along that path, let's go this direction. You know, what do you think is one of the most challenging aspects of working with kids in schools today?
You know, I actually now start, I do a lot of professional developments with districts. And when I do it with a district, it's often too large to do one thing that's my favorite thing to do, which is when I get to work with specific grade levels. And I actually will focus on that question with them, so that I can gear what we're going to be talking about. And the content always is able to be gotten out along that path or through that template. You know, what are you looking at? What are your biggest hurdles? You know, what are you trying to do? And where do you see the obstacles that prevent you from that the most? And I think they are, you know, right out of their mouth comes exactly what I would say and agree are the biggest obstacles today in teaching. And they're a little bit different at the early grades than the upper grades. I mean, across the board, you know, we do have the issue that there's obviously a lot of assessments, and I'm one that thinks assessments are a good thing. You know, I think, and you know, you have to know what your assessment drives your instruction. So knowing what, where kids are, what they need, you know, where they are, where they were, where they're going, that gives teachers a lot of good information. Now, the type of assessment is the trick. You know, what type of assessment and what access do teachers have to really pull out what they need to get from that assessment? And then can it be used to drive instruction? Oftentimes, you know, it's assessment for assessment's sake, and I think that's where teachers can get very overwhelmed. So that can be a real problem if it starts to encroach on the time you need to actually teach the skills that are going to be assessed. And I think having taught for such a long period of time, you see everything's come up a level. Kinder's really the new first grade. First grade's the new second grade, you know. In other words, you know, if you taught Kinder before, you know, back when I started teaching, you know, you had a finger painting time during the day. You had a little nap time during the day. There were reflection opportunities during the day and kind of created open-ended time frames. Now there's reading series. Pre-K is what Kinder used to be. Kinder's now really what first grade once was. You know, it used to be that, you know, you learn to read so that you can read to learn, and that hump was crossed around third grade. But, you know, with test prep, second grade has to start really preparing to become competent with reading to learn. And again, that's not a bad thing. It's just that it puts teachers in a position to do things sometimes that are not always aligned with where kids are. So one example, for instance, of the early grades, and I think, you know, this is where there are these gaps. That's probably one of the biggest issues today. And again, one of the reasons kids have so many gaps in terms of, you know, you're trying to accelerate and remediate all at the same time. You've got kids that, you know, are in kinder. They just want to lick their shoe and play with the carpet. And then you've got other kids who've been reading for a year and they want to move. And I think those gaps often are the result, again, of where we need to head and when we need to start heading there. And from a developmental readiness perspective, that starts the ball rolling in a way that sets up even larger gaps as kids go up through the year. That's part of why the brain science is so important, because with the levels of expectation rising, what teachers have to do to meet those expectations are often not what research shows is most effective. For example, sight word memorization. You know, if a kindergartner has to be reading at a particular level at the end of the year, you know, and you're doing well just to teach them their individual letter sounds, which from a curriculum perspective is typically all that's supposed to be there, plus a bunch of sight words. And those sight words fill in the gap for what kids can't read, which is a lot since we divvy up the code across three grade levels. So those sight words take a lot of time. If you've got a kid who wants to play and just move and can't sit still, he doesn't want to have a word flashed in his face 45 times. He doesn't want to see the letter K on a card 15 times. That's not developmentally appropriate. But yet, you know, that's what teachers often will have to resort to achieve a particular level. And when they do that, the time lost from actually teaching the reading, you know, you want to teach the reader, not the reading. So if all the focus is on teaching the reading, you develop these gaps because summer comes. And, you know, Dr. Allington, this is a huge piece of his research, is the summer slide. you know, you use it or lose it. And our kids who don't have access to books at home, our kids who aren't, you know, maybe from a house where parents are going to read or give them opportunities to engage with text, you know, they lose a ton of ground, especially when it's never really learned but memorized. All those sight words that you work so hard to put in can just disappear by the time they start school the next year. And the kids left without much, there's not much left over. They didn't have time to really learn to read. The time was spent on memorizing the words, and that's not the same. And I just talked to a principal yesterday who was saying, you know, their fourth and fifth grader really struggling, more so now than in previous years, because they really are struggling with basic reading. And I am kind of convinced that a lot of those assessment rises at the early grade levels, pushing teachers to over rely on sight word memorization, not enough time to actually teach the reading, meaning you've got kids who aren't readers. You know, they can do certain reading, but the time spent to really hone those skills as a reader and a writer are being unfortunately shifted to time spent practicing the reading so they can get through this level of this book. They know these controlled vocabulary words. And it's taking a toll. So now more than ever, the brain science helps teachers figure out where they're going. And I think that's probably the biggest hurdle I see for the early grades, more so than the upper, is knowing why they're doing what they're doing. They're given so much to do. And so many times one thing overlaps the other, or one thing completely contradicts the other. And if they don't look up and try to see the forest through the trees, I think sometimes they can be running around with a basketball and they don't really know where the net is. And that's a huge, just a huge problem. One thing a teacher told me was, she said, I feel like I'm just spinning my wheels and I'm not doing anything well. You know, and that I think is how it can feel when there's a basket over here and a basket over here and a basket over there and a basket over there and you've got the ball and you're just trying to run to all these baskets and you never really stop and think, okay, wait a minute. Let's get a game plan. What am I actually trying to do here? What's the purpose of me throwing the ball in that basket? And if I skipped that basket and went two circles over here first and then shot it, I could take out both those baskets at the same time. And I think a lot of teachers sometimes are so overwhelmed with all the things they're supposed to do that they're not always aware of why they're doing them and where they're headed with them. And I see that as just a huge common thread among teachers across grade levels. And upper grade teachers, really same thing from the other end. You know, again, how do I fill in gaps? How do I group kids if I've got readers that go from a first grade level to a seventh grade level? And I'm a regular ed fourth grade teacher. What do I do? How do I, it's not Little House on the Prairie. You know, I'm not prepared to teach the kids that are this high and that are that high. What do I do when they're all over the map? I don't have reading skills for teaching reading. And I'm a fourth grade teacher. So how do I meet those needs while I maintain the course of my on grade level and the momentum of my on grade level instruction?
That's awesome information there, because that's, you know, the big understanding of what stages the kids are in and what you really need to be doing that's going to get you kind of your, you know, have the greatest impact, and what, you know, what you may need to give up that's not really having that impact. And, you know, with those different baskets that you're talking about all together. And I heard you talk in there and you started mentioning about brain, you know, the brain studies and brain research. And so let's go there. Let's talk about brain research for just a minute. When you talk about or mention it, what really are you referring to? And you already talked a little bit about this, but let's kind of get into that, why the teacher should understand a little bit about this and want to know more.
Yeah, there's so many things teachers, as a teacher, there's so many things you want to know or need to know or feel like you should know. And the one, and I'm always about bang for the buck. You know, there's 1,000 directions you can go off and run in, and some will help you do this and some will make you better at doing that. But the one thing that's going to kind of knock out every single shell in your path is the brain research, because it's a roadmap for teachers to know how we actually learn best, whether we're learning math, whether we're learning science, whether we're learning how to behave. You know, the brain science, it's not just about the generic templates or concepts of learning. It literally helps you hone your path so that you can go, you can teach better, stronger, faster. And it's not such a trial and error, because I think as a teacher, it can feel like a trial and error, especially for a newer teacher. You know, you try 1,000 different things and you finally hit on something that works. And then you take horrible, you have horrible remorse for the first 3 years of your classes that you didn't know that when you were teaching them. And if you had, maybe little Philip would have done better. But when you know how the brain learns, when you know, it's like a chess opponent. You know, when you know your opponent, you know where to move because you know what they're going to do. So part of what, and I'll explain what I mean with brain science, but part of what I like to look at the most is using the brain against itself, not just aligning what we do with how the brain learns, but knowing how to cheat the brain knowing where the hurdles lie in the battles we fight every day and why they're there. You know, why do kids do this when I do that? Why is it every time I try to teach this, that's always what happens? If you understand your opponent, then you completely can get what's going to happen when you make this move. And so then you don't make that move. You make this move instead. And then voila, you end up in a different place. So I like to use that science equally, not just to align with it, but to work against it. And it's a fascinating thing if you have that practical experience. And that's one thing neuroscientists don't have. They are giving us the roadmaps that as teachers we can take and run wild with. But they don't have that practical experience to know where the inherent obstacles are on a daily basis with different groups of kids at different grade levels. If they do know that, or if they did know that, it would really just make everything make sense in terms of some of the findings that they share. And as a teacher, you connect those dots instantly and say, that makes sense. And so now I can do it this way. And I can obliterate, not just know how to get around the hurdle, because I think that's what a lot of us spend the most time with, is how do I get around this? I know this is going to be a big, you know, obstacle in trying to teach such and such. So how I can do this, I learned this activity, this will help get that to be easier. What if the obstacle just weren't there? What if the way that you presented the lesson didn't automatically create the obstacle, and then all of a sudden you don't have to get around anything? You actually just get to move, get to hit the ground running. And that's where the cheating part comes in. And it really is just, in a nutshell, you know, how our brains actually learn best. That's the brain science focus. I can, you know, name some specific people that I personally like to really look at their work and tie it to the literacy aspect. But it all boils down to any of the brain science you really look at, just how our brains actually learn best. And you can't, it's not a philosophical debate. There's no philosophy in there. It's an MRI scan. You know, it's a CAT scan. It's an MRI. It's a mirror image of what's happening when you're teaching one way versus another, and seeing different areas light up and engage, and knowing that the more areas that engage, the deeper the learning and the stronger the retention. So it's not like when we were in college, when you had all these professors and, you know, they all had their sides of, you know, they never told you how to teach reading, but they told you how everybody felt about how you were about to teach reading. And some felt very differently about one path than the other. And the teachers were left kind of going, well, what do I just do with Johnny? So the brain science tells us what you can do with Johnny. And it doesn't mince words. I can't imagine teaching without that knowledge, actually.
Oh, that's awesome. And that's going to, you know, lead me into the next part, because one of the things that I've heard you say is I've heard you say that our brains learn best on a need-to-know basis, which I'm guessing comes through that brain research that you're talking about. Can you talk specifically about what you mean by that?
Absolutely. This is where a couple of the researchers that I personally love to read, and especially looking at some of their articles that come out, and then the research pieces that they've done. Helen Mordino Yang is one in particular, and you know, she has an equation that I'm going to share, because I just recently had come across it. Curiosity equals an emotional hook plus a baseline understanding. You know, the need to ask why. Why is critical thinking in real time? And when a learner approaches information and the desire to get that information is coming from them, they're actually coming for it because they have a need to know it. They want to know it. That information that's given to them is then marked for memory in the brain. So if you want to know something, you are acquiring, or that information is entering in a completely different way than when a teacher tells you something that you have no idea what she's talking about. Why? I mean, she's just tossing it out like a ball and there's no catcher on the field. You know, kids aren't asking for it. They have no interest in it, perhaps, no personal connection for it. You can toss it out, and teachers often have to, but it might take 10 times of tossing it out before it finally sticks. It's literally like a ball you're just throwing and no one's prepared. If a learner asks why, if they have the need to know, then there's a catcher's mitt in place in the brain that's already there. It's like a file folder that's already open because something prompted that need to know. And that's a connection that's already there, which means it's a little bit quicker to stick and it's easier to retrieve. I think the real question comes with, how do you get a kid who has no need to know to need to know? You know, because teachers, we all have our intellectually curious students, the ones who, you know, why, can you tell me this? I want to know that. They give us those great teachable moments, and then we go off on a tangent and talk about what we wanted to talk about anyway, but now we've got this great in for it. It's the kids, again, who are licking their shoe and playing with the carpet. You know, ignorance is bliss. So if kids don't know, what they don't know, then they have no need to know. If you don't know what you don't know, the world's your oyster. You're happy just hanging around. So for those kids, you know, we need to be able to instill a need to know in those guys as well. And ideally it would come from background experience, but as teachers, we can't control that. You know, we can't control whether, you know, they've been read to at home and whether they engage in conversations at home. What we can do though is cheat the brain again. So you can actually trigger a need to know in a kid who has no need to know whatsoever. And you can do it with little tricks. One is novelty. Anything that comes out of the blue. If I change my vocal expression, which I probably just threw your microphones way off, an extreme body gesture, anything that comes out of the norm will trigger immediate concentrated attention from the brain, which if they don't even have to, the only need to know there is what the heck is she doing? But that's a need to know. And the neat part is that creates the same chemistry as if a learner actually needs to know because they want to know the answer to that question, because they brought something to the table that triggered that curiosity. But ideally that would be the case, but for kids who don't bring that to the table, we can still trigger that physiological need to know by using these little tricks. And that's a survival mechanism. You know, we are programmed, our brains it's the brain's way to attend to immediate response of something that comes out of the norm, because that's a protective mechanism. So it doesn't matter what causes them to need to know. The point is, when they look up at you to figure out what the heck you're doing or what's going on, you've got about 4.5 seconds of this concentrated level of attention that if you can capture it and use it, you've got that catcher's mitt in place. And then another trick is secrets. You know, everybody wants what they can't have. That's human nature. If I've got it and you want it and I get to decide whether or not you can have it, then all of a sudden you're tuned in just because you don't want to miss out. So even though they don't know what the secret's about, nobody wants to miss it. And again, that's just another need to know. So you can foster these moments to get that level of engagement, not just to keep them interested and engaged, but from a brain perspective, to mark that information for memory so that you're not saying something 10 times, maybe you're saying it twice. You know, it's got some sticky piece that's now already connected to it, which means it has a place to live. It's got a way to come back and be retrieved. It's got a connection there. You didn't just toss a ball out in left field and it went right by, you know, the kid who you were trying to throw it to. So just those little kind of tricks. And I think teachers talk a lot about that engagement and call outs, but they don't always take it home and go to the brain piece behind it. And that's really where I think, you know, I see a lot of teachers say, you know, I'll say me, you say you, I'll say A, you say B, like a call out to trigger attention. That's awesome. But why? What is it doing? You know, why are you doing what you're doing? Because if you know, you can play with it and make it your own and do even more creative things. So that's always my third piece, is that take it home. Let teachers not just know what to do, but why to do it. Anchor it in something so they can play with it in a lot of different directions and use their own expertise to really, you know, make it bigger, better, stronger, faster.
I love that. And I got to tell you, that last little bit right there that you keyed in on, that once they understand why it works and what they're actually doing, then they can understand how to replicate it in something else instead of just trying to repeat the same type of lesson and actually know what's happened. So
yeah, and teachers, you know, there's this they have this pot of expertise and this incredible background knowledge that they bring. I mean, I shared my background. I've met teachers who have taught, you know, high school, and then they went into second grade, and then they taught fifth grade, and now they're back in high school. And I mean, they everyone, you know, this rich experience base that we have, when you just drop one little piece into your pot and let it stew and stir, the things that can come out of that can make what I'm even suggesting pale in comparison to effectiveness. So that's where the power really lies, I think, in terms of equipping teachers with what they need, isn't telling them what to do, but giving them the tools and the understanding of where they're going to head with those tools. And then letting them play to get there and measure their effectiveness at being able to do it. But, you know, never underestimate the power of a good teacher, because their creative force, their drive, their passion, all the things that come into play when they're making something their own is not even comparable to what they have to do when they're looking at page 14 and teaching the lesson that's the scripted lesson for the day. You're just cutting out the most powerful resource you have, which is the teacher, you know, themselves. So that's where I think knowing why you're doing what you're doing gives the power back to the teacher to take it and run in any direction she needs to. And not knowing why you're doing, but just knowing, hey, this trick works, it just minimizes the power. And also then the problem can lie that when teachers make it their own, they might tweak it in a direction that lessens its effectiveness. because they don't know exactly why it was so powerful. You know, and I see that a lot as well, is, you know, the whole point of knowing why you're doing what you're doing is so you can figure out a game plan and make it a tighter, more streamlined game plan. If you don't know why you're doing it, you might kind of play with it just enough that then it doesn't really seem to work anymore. So the whole power to play lies in their knowing, you know, what it is, what it does, and how to use it. And keeping that as big of a common denominator as you can, so they're always getting the most brain bang for their buck. It's not just one thing to teach one thing. It's a context in which to just teach anything, to teach everything. I focus on literacy, but, you know, those who are much smarter than me in different content areas can run in those directions.
That is so cool. That is, you know, it's so powerful what you're talking about. And that actually works really well to kind of segue and get us into, I want you to tell us what Secret Stories is.
You know, in a nutshell, Secret Stories are just the logical explanations that the brain craves for why letters do what they do when they don't do what they should. Because, you know, every parent who's ever read a story to their child has experienced how frustrating it can be when kids actually call you on the carpet about letters that they're spotting in the book and how they never seem to be making the sound that Mrs. Baker said.
I love that.
You know, and it's a constant. And it's so frustrating when you always find yourself having to say, you know, it just is, it just does, you just have to remember. And unfortunately, that is the truth, you know. And people can say, no, it's not, there's phonics. Phonics doesn't explain why K says K, not even a little. K says K because it just does. It just is, and you just have to remember. Why does a K have sticks and an O or an M has curvy parts? Because it is, because it does, and you just have to remember. So, you know, phonics is an organizational structure upon which our language is built. It's not meaningful explanations that the brain craves. The brain always wants to go, oh, I get it. It's a pattern-making machine, and it wants to connect the patterns it already knows with those that it identifies. And when those connections can be made and that new learning occurs, you get that satisfying, you know, brain burp. I call it a brain burp. And that's that, oh. And you rarely get that when it comes to what letters say. Because there's nothing that meaningful you could possibly have said. Because there's really no inherent meaning. So there needs to be. Because if there isn't any meaning, and it just isn't, it just doesn't, you just have to remember. What that means is it's a use it or lose it pathway for acquisition. And that cuts out half of our learners. You know, use it or lose it means somebody's got to look in your backpack. Somebody's got to give you access to the books that you need to do the assignment. Somebody's got to make sure you have pencils at home and some paper. Somebody's got to actually do something with you over the summer. Or you have to have the desire internally to get yourself to a library to find a book. You know, that use it or lose it route to acquiring these skills is one that really makes for a very unlevel playing field for a lot of our learners. And if that is their only route to accessing these critical skills, then it is absolutely no wonder why we have so many kids who struggle with reading, because there's no way to, it doesn't matter how smart you are, you know, you can't understand what has no sense. If there's no meaning, there is no method for deduction and analytical problem solving. If you have to have logic to do those things. This is use it or lose it. You know it because you do it. Kids who do it are going to get it. Kids who don't are going to have holes. And it just, again, sets up a foundation with a lot of gaps for those kids when they go up into grade levels where the focus is supposed to be on reading to learn, and yet they're still struggling with the learning to read, and your brain can't do both of those things at the same time. And then upper grade teachers will often divert to comprehension activities and practice, and yet often the issue is automaticity with text. You know, if you read something to a fourth or fifth grader and they laugh at the funny part and they want to tell you how they went to the same place last summer with, you know, when they were home and they got to do this too, they comprehend just fine. Their problem is they can't comprehend when they also have to do the reading. And I think third, fourth, and fifth grade teachers often don't feel as comfortable focusing on automaticity with text because that's not their thing. So comprehension then, like sight words in the early grades, comprehension becomes the main focus in upper grades. And while there's certainly not, I mean, that's the goal of what reading is the bridge we cross to learn, to communicate. But the bridge has to be there. And if the bridge isn't there and you're always carrying them across the bridge, then what you're teaching them to do on the other side is not really that helpful if they can't ever get there without you being a part of that equation. And, you know, there are a lot of people that, you know, Tim Shanahan is one of, you know, my idols. And he talks a lot about this, you know, in the context of, you know, we talk about fluency. We talk about all these higher level goals with text. But the automaticity with text is something that we're just often skirting around and playing with the problems we face on the other side of the bridge that's not there. And sometimes it helps to put things back in perspective. And I think part of why we avoid dealing with that particular animal is because how do you imagine to go back and teach 3 years worth of stuff when they didn't get it during those 3 years? And that's where the brain science comes in. Because if there's a logical reason, if there's something that, if there's meaning where otherwise there wouldn't have been, you don't have to practice it. It doesn't take 3 years. You just walk away and go, oh, and then it's yours. So that's where it becomes possible. You know, you just like kindergartners can open up a door and access the whole code, third and fourth graders who never had access to the code before can do exactly the same. So you're not having to do the unthinkable, which is go back and how do I reteach 3 years of stuff they didn't get or make up for all this lack of time on text and lack of experience with text. You know, readers, kids that don't read, kids that can't read, don't read. So they go to fourth grade, you know, with minimal text experience. And again, that's daunting for upper grade teachers to figure out how to work with a kid who's got years lost. And the brain science just gives us a different path. You don't have to take that path. And I think, again, that's where those compensation measures come in. We're used to having to take that path and go around those obstacles. And we don't have to with the when we take advantage of that brain science. And I think you asked me to go back to end your actual question with a real answer. And I mentioned Helen Mordino-Yang, who is a neuroscientist, but one who really well connects, I think, to practitioners in a classroom, the importance of the learners driving their own instruction, and that starting with the need to know. And if you have a need to know, you need to be able to channel the information to that need to know. And the only thing that's going to spark kids to have a need to know is if they're going after meaning, something that actually makes sense. And that's where this kind of comes together. You know, a need to know requires that there's something you can logically tell them to account for it. Otherwise, they will stop asking why, because the answer is always, it just is. It just does. So for curiosity to flourish and drive instruction, there has to be something satisfying that kids are going to get to that purpose. And she talks a lot about that for different content areas, everything from calculus to science to chemistry to reading. You know, don't be afraid, she says, to find meaning. And even if you've got to be real creative to do it, find meaning in these abstract content areas. Because only by finding meaning can you foster this need to know, and that need to know is the key to drive the easiest learning. So, and I've done that in literacy, but there's such an open playing field for others to do this in the areas that they, you know, have this passion for.
Well, that's so awesome. The because that all that information yells at you that I need to know more, because it's the more I know and understand about this, the better I'm going to be in working with the kids. And I just love this. And I'm going to use this to kind of segue into, you know, I during a presentation, I heard you talk about the superhero vowels, and I was hoping you'd specifically get into mommy E and sneaky Y, but can you explain what your topic of the superhero vowels is all about?
What a great place to stop, huh? Awesome info today. So you learned a little bit about who Katie is, kids, brain research, our brains and how they learn best, and what Secret Stories really is. Next time, we'll pick up where we left off with learning about, that's right, the superhero vowels. Dun, dun, dun. Stay tuned. Same bat channel, same bat time. Dun, 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 dun.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and hosts. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends. Take care.